One final thing we need to cover at the end of Lesson 7 is this is kind of where we put the story of Job. A couple of comments about the book of Job. It's under the additional notes on Lesson 7. If I've handed out Lesson 8 to you this morning, just hang tight. We'll be there in just a second. But we're kind of doing a chronological examination of how Scriptures and the stories of Scriptures lay out. And Job is probably the most difficult book to place in time. The Job, all we know for sure is that he is a confirmed historical person. It is not a fictitious story. It was not made up to make some moral point about enduring and receiving some blessings. Job existed. His story is true. There are at least two reasons why we know that to be the case. One of them is one of your Old Testament prophets, Ezekiel, notes Job's story. He's talking about the people there in Israel and the judgment that's coming upon them. And he said, not even if Noah, Daniel, and Job were here today, would God save all you guys? He'd save them, but he wouldn't save you. So Ezekiel, that's a passage I gave you in Ezekiel chapter 14. He actually brings up twice, in verse 14 and verse 20, Job's name. But I would say more to the point is James chapter 5, verse 11. Did you know that Job is mentioned in your New Testament? In James chapter 5, verse 11, we count those blessed who endured. You have heard of the endurance of Job and have seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings, that the Lord is full of compassion and is merciful. Now, you might read that and say, well, it's just some Old Testament sort of fictitious story and he's just bringing it back up for emphasis sake. But he connects the Lord to Job. He connects the story of Job to the compassion and mercy of God. That's a true story. So those are at least two of the quite lengthy amount of reasons why we can place Job in the historical narrative. However, we don't know where to put him. Dating the book of Job is very difficult. Job may have lived in the patriarchal age. Why would we say that it's highly likely that Job is in the patriarchal age? Why would you say that? God spoke to him. God spoke to a lot of people, patriarchs, in the patriarchal age. Now, he did that during the Jewish age as well, but it was less frequent. That's a good point. Why else? Think absence of something. What's not in the book of Job? Who's not in the book of Job?
Israelites.
You have no mention of the Israelites. You have no mention of the law of Moses. That's kind of significant. I wouldn't say that that seals the deal on dating it, but the absence there is something that's interesting. All we know for sure is that Job's story predates Ezekiel in 600 BC. We know that because Ezekiel references him. He references these characters. Some live close to him and some live far away like Noah. The outline of the book of Job, because this is a survey and we're sort of working through time, we certainly don't have the opportunity to go through all of this important and needful book. But here's a basic outline. I want you to be able to use page 29 if you're getting ready to read the story of Job or you're trying to remember in your mind the way that it lays out. You might find this useful. The first three chapters, Job is allowed by God to suffer at the hands of Satan. And you remember a lot of the specifics about how serious that got. Large section of the book of Job, Job's three friends converse with him. Their advice is clouded by this false idea that if you suffer, you must have sinned. Now, where would they have gotten that idea? From all over the place. All over the place that happens. But it is not an absolute, and in Job's case, it was not. So they keep trying to convince him of that. This fourth younger man, my favorite in the line, shows up in chapters 32 through 37 and says, I've been listening to you guys for three rounds of conversations. I've listened to you guys all talk, and I've got it all figured out. Check this out. And he opens his mouth. He says nothing new. He says the exact same thing the other three guys did. He didn't get it either. End of the book of Job, the Lord and Job have a conversation. The most powerful element in the book is when Job finally gets his day in court with God. And God gives him 100 questions and says, just answer one for me, just one, and I'll tell you anything you want to know. And of course, it was about how the universe was put in place and how God established the sustenance of our planet, and Job had nothing. Job is humbled and learns valuable lessons about God's greatness. In the end, God restores the fortunes of Job, quote from chapter 42, and even increases those fortunes twofold. Now, when you get done reading that story, you think, great, twofold is great, but he still lost all 10 of his original children. Well, there's a point to that. Here, it doesn't work exactly that way. You don't get everything back the way that it was. That's not the way that blessings on earth work. That's why we're headed towards heaven. However, God can help you cope with your loss, find strength, and even restore blessings around you so that you can make it through life with a lot of joy. So that's Job's story. You know the story. Just wanted you to see that in additional notes. Didn't want to fly over it too quickly. Any comments or questions about him? Anybody lock down the date on that? Nah, don't even answer. All right. I will say this. Don't skip it. I think there's something that says, I know the story of Job. And so when it comes to Bible reading or something, or sometime you're spending in the Old Testament, you think, I got this. I've heard the story of Job. Do not skip the book of Job this year. I finished it maybe a month ago or so, and I was blown away by some things I hadn't even seen before. First of all, the friends were right some of the time. They had a lot of good advice. Just their overall way they saw life was wrong. Job was kind of the opposite. Job made a lot of mistakes. I think he did some things downright wrong in terms of his approach, but his overall picture of God was righteous. Really interesting the way that those guys are compared. All right, let's get to our drill questions. I know that's what you're waiting for, Chris. Just get to the drill. So lesson 8, questions on the left. And we'll pick up with the captivities and the southern kingdom. Question 1, when did the Jewish kingdom divide, and what were the names of the two kingdoms thereafter? When did it divide, split? 931. Who was the first king of the north? And the first king of the south? Rehoboam. And what did you call the kingdom of the north? And the south. All right. Which tribes were in the south? Judah, Benjamin, which is sort of an appendage of Judah in a sense, and of course the Levites. All right. So you had 10 north and 3 south. Would you agree with that statement? But hey, that's 13. There's supposed to be 12. Anybody know the answer to that? Joseph's two sons replaced Joseph. So you ended up with 13 because Joseph's Manasseh and Ephraim, the sons, replaced them. So you have 10 up north, which you don't have to remember all those, but the ones in the south are more significant. Judah, Benjamin, and of course your Levites. How long did the northern kingdom last, and to whom did they fall? Okay, about 200 years, 209 years, 931 to 722, and then the Assyrians came in and wiped them out. What new nationality grew out of the mixture of the Assyrians and Israel? Samaritans, which is a really strong position. You see a lot about the Samaritans in the Gospels. That's where they began. How long did the southern kingdom last before a fall, and to whom did they fall? A lot longer, the southern kingdoms. Those 8 or 9 godly kings they had really helped them out. They lasted about 325 years until Babylon, led by King... If you say it, you have to spell it. It's got a chad in the middle. That'll really help you. Nebuchadnezzar. All right, Nebuchadnezzar came, and the Babylonians, and they attacked 3 times. This is what you'll see in today's class. They came in, took a lot of guys, a lot of people, killed some people, came back a second time, did it again, and then came back a third time and really just made sure they wiped everything out on that third attack. You'll see all that today. What is a prophet in short? What's the short definition of a prophet? Seer. Seer is good, but man of God. What's a short definition of what he does? Speaks for God. Spokesperson for God. Could be telling you the future. Could be telling you the present. Could be telling you the past. Usually they put future things in there to prove that they're prophets so that you'll believe what they're saying about the present. And that was Deuteronomy 18. It talked about if what they say comes true, then you know you should listen to everything that they're telling you. What is the difference between an oral prophet and a literary prophet? Okay, we don't have a record of their written notes. So an oral prophet like, and I think it's on your sheet here, Elijah and Elisha, they were people who may have written things down, but the northern kingdom wouldn't have kept that stuff around. So we just have their oral testimony. Literary prophets wrote things down, like Hosea and Micah and Nahum and Jeremiah. I probably won't say it right this time, but something about all literary prophets are oral because they spoke and wrote, but not all oral prophets wrote things down. So that's the difference there. Question 6, we just answered, who were 2 great oral prophets? Elijah and then Elisha. And where would you go in the Bible to read about those 2 amazing, amazing guys? First and Second Kings, latter part of First Kings. That's when your kingdom divides in First Kings 11. It divides. And so what's going to happen in the north? Well, you track Elijah and Elisha's interaction with the north and you find out about that. Why was their job harder than some of the other prophets?
People didn't want to hear.
They didn't want to hear. These were God's people in the north. 20 kings in the north, 200 years, all evil, godless folk. In fact, Jonah did better going to Nineveh than Elisha and Elijah did going to God's people in the north. Really just fascinating about how far you can slide if you aren't careful. What are the books we call the major prophets? Firstly, who can list the major prophets? Isaiah. Let's go in order. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel. Why is that called the major prophets? Because you better find a comfortable place if you're going to sit down and read them. Now, Lamentations actually isn't all that long, so what's it doing in there with the major prophets? Jeremiah wrote it. Very interesting book, often skipped, Lamentations. Jeremiah saw the burned city in 586 B.C., had to watch his people, his friends, his neighbors die, and he picked up a pen and he wrote about it, Lamentations. So that's why we call those the major ones. I will not ask you to list the minor ones, but you would pick up with Joel next. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel. You pick up with Joel and you go all the way through Malachi. Got 12 of them there. They're called minor because they're shorter. That's it. Some of them are pretty lengthy, maybe 14 chapters or so. I think Hosea perhaps. But most of them are within 5 or 6 average chapters, something like that. All right. That's a little bit about what we've covered so far. Again, please give reference frequently to the last couple of pages whenever you're in the minor prophets. You want to know, to whom did that man go? When did that man go to them? That's huge. Just answering those two questions, who's he writing to and when, will tell you a lot about the context of what you're going to be reading. All right, let's take a look then at some of page 30. Let's talk a bit about the Babylonian captivity. Due to habitual unfaithfulness, Judah, the southern kingdom, was sentenced to 70 years of captivity at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar and his forces. Now, before Nebuchadnezzar attacked that first time, the people knew it was coming. Who told them? Which prophet told them, here's who is coming, here's what's going to happen, and here's how long you're going to have to deal with it? Jeremiah. Take a look at that with me for a moment. Jeremiah, I think you'll find the numbering here kind of interesting. If you're visiting today and you've not been a part of our class and you've showed up for lesson 8 and you don't like numbers, I'm sorry. Lesson 8 is right in the doldrums of the numbers and the dating, and I love it, but most people don't. But there are a few things here that might be interesting to you if you'd work on these. Firstly, Jeremiah chapter 25. Jeremiah, really fascinating prophet. He lasted a long time. He saw a lot of things. He saw them before Nebuchadnezzar's attack, during and after. And in Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 8, thus says the Lord of hosts, because you have not obeyed my words, behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, declares the Lord, and I will send to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, my servant, and will bring them against this land and against its inhabitants and against all these nations, and I will utterly destroy them. Now look at verse 11. This whole land will be a desolation and a horror, and these nations will serve the king of Babylon 70 years. He says it again, I believe, in chapter 29. Let's take a quick look over at 29 around. Yeah, verse 10. Just to note that he says it at least twice. In Jeremiah chapter 29 and verse 10, when 70 years have been completed for Babylon, I will visit you and fulfill my good word to you and bring you back to this place. So Jeremiah gave them the entire picture. Here's who is coming. Here's what they're going to do. 70 years you'll suffer. In chapter 29, he picks back up with the story and says, however, at the end of 70 years, I will let you go home. Now, what's interesting about numbers in the Bible is you almost have to assume that they're figurative, almost, until they're proven literal. Kind of depends on which prophet you're reading. Sometimes it's the opposite. Assume that it's literal unless there's something figurative. In this case, there is a literal fulfillment of the number that Jeremiah gave them. Look on your sheet there near the top. In about 605-606, Nebuchadnezzar, B.C., Nebuchadnezzar goes into Jerusalem, takes tons of captives with him. That's the first captivity. In 536 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar, well, he's gone by now, but the Babylonians fall, the Persians replace them, and Cyrus, one of Cyrus Persian king's first edicts is, the Jewish people, they're now called the Jewish people for the first time, you get to go home. Now, if you've got your iPhone calculator out or a really sharp mind or an abacus, anybody bring it up? No. 606 to 536 is 70 years. It was 70 years from the first day they were taken to the first day that they were allowed to return. 70 years. There is another way that you can date this. As you'll note on the material today, Nebuchadnezzar attacked them three times. The third time was 586 B.C. That's a real sort of ironclad, important number in Israelite history. In 586 B.C., he comes in a third time and he destroys the most precious thing in Jerusalem, the temple. Solomon's temple, their place of worship, their holy of holies, their golden instruments, all of it is destroyed in 586. So in 536, they all come home to rubble. In 516, they rebuild the temple. Temple was broken. This is an even easier one, right? All you have to do is just subtract the middle number. 586, temple broken down. 516, temple finished and rebuilt for a difference of 70 years. So there are two ways you can calculate this. If you ask me which one was he talking about, I think he was talking about the first one, because the second one wasn't supposed to take 70 years. When they got back in 536, God said, rebuild this thing. And they drug their feet for about 16 years until finally these two great prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, showed up and just preached them. And then they finished it. So it ended up being 70 years on the temple, but it should have been a lot less than that. All right. All of what Jeremiah says unfolds for you in the story of the Chronicles. 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles, I have that noted on your material. The event unfolds just like Jeremiah said in 2 Chronicles. You can read about Nebuchadnezzar, all three of his attacks. It'll tell you how old he was when he came to town. You can easily do the math on all that taking place. He wasn't the only one who announced this, though. Turn over and see if you can find the book of Habakkuk. First one there, ring the bell. Habakkuk, I got lucky, it fell open to it. When you get there, tell me something about Habakkuk. You can draw it out of whatever your Bible tells you at the beginning. You can turn back in your Bible survey one page and look at the little chart that we gave you and the little subscript about Habakkuk. Tell me about this guy. I want to know to whom and when, first thing. Josh is about to answer. He didn't even have it in front of him. He's just about to go. Yeah, tell me about Habakkuk. Habakkuk's writing a letter. Who's he writing it to? Writing it to the southern kingdom of Judah. Would you agree with that? About what year?
Here in the Babylonian era.
Okay. If I look back, right there, okay? Habakkuk is writing a letter, and you can see this on the chart on page 29. He's writing the letter to the southern kingdom. Of course, by this time, the northern kingdom is long gone. He's writing it in about 607, 608, 609. That is right before Nebuchadnezzar got there. Yes?
Why does it take, oh Lord, how long I cry for help? You hear me? It says in
here,
Habakkuk's complaint to God.
Well, he definitely shared within that narrative. She's right in the sense that the letter picks up with Habakkuk asking God, God, how long will you put up with the behavior of your people? And God answered him, I would tell you, but it would devastate you. And what's happening is Habakkuk's writing down his conversation with God. She's right about that. And he's allowing those in Judah to read it. He's saying, look, I just had this conversation with God. I asked him how long he was going to put up with you guys. And he said, it's coming, and it's coming very, very swiftly. Repent. They didn't. And he attacked. So she's right. When you get into the context of it, there's a lot of dialogue with God. But knowing that this dialogue with God happened a year before Nebuchadnezzar got there gives you all the information you need to really get the impact of Habakkuk's short letter. All right, so here's the point about that. In Habakkuk chapter 1, that's what's being laid out here. This idea of how long, O Lord, verse 2. Verse 5, look among the nations, observe, God says. Be astonished and wonder, because I am doing something in your days you would not believe if you were told. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans. Little side note, that's the same as the Babylonians. Chaldeans, Babylonians, synonymous terms. That'll help you in Bible study. Chaldeans is used more often than Babylonians. To seize the dwelling places that are not theirs. And he goes on through this. Verse 11, they will sweep through like the wind and pass on, but they will be held guilty, those whose strength is in their God. In other words, eventually I'll take care of them as well. So here's my point to this. It wasn't just Jeremiah saying this is coming. There were several prophets who were giving them the same message. And had they heeded it, they could have lived, but they didn't heed it. So the Babylonians come in right after that, and they attack Jerusalem three times. Each time, more people are taken. So right about the middle of page 30, you have some information there I'm just going to leave to you. 605, some were taken. Here's what I want you to remember. Daniel was taken in that first attack. You guys remember the story of Daniel? He's about 18 years old. He's been taken by the king, and he's told to eat certain kind of meats, and he won't do it, and he prays to God, and God blesses him. You know the whole story of Daniel, right? The context of that story is right here. Nebuchadnezzar attacks the city and says, you know, let me just take back the best of the best, the most noble, the most wise. So they take back Daniel. He was taken in the first captivity. And then, not long after, 2 Kings 24 tells you all about this, he goes back again in 597, takes more, including a man named Ezekiel. All right, so Daniel's already there. He's in the palace. Ezekiel gets taken. Where's he going to be? If you're a captive and you're not serving in the palace, where are you? I guess the thing. Yeah, dungeon. In this case, it's sort of like the prison camp, like where all the captives are held. He's over there. So I want you to think about perspective. When you tell a story from three angles, you really get a lot about that story. Daniel is going to tell you the story of what happened from the perspective of the king's castle. He's going to tell you about Nebuchadnezzar and what was going on in his head during all this time and how he actually had little elements of faith. One of the most faithful verses in the Old Testament in chapter 3 of Daniel was uttered by Nebuchadnezzar of all people. Fascinating guy. Ultimately, his service of false gods cost him. So you've got Daniel reporting from the palace. You have Ezekiel, who will start reporting from the prison camp, same time. And then thirdly, he comes in 586 and destroys the temple, and Jeremiah is left behind. There are your three perspectives. Jeremiah, when he writes, he's going to write to you what it was like to be left in Jerusalem after three attacks and a burnt down city, and we're running to Egypt hoping that that saves us. He tells that whole story, the left behind story. Ezekiel tells the captive story. Daniel tells the captive but privileged story. When you read all three, it's just amazing. It really is. It fills in all these gaps on what was going on along the way. So those three men are contemporaries, and that's their difference in their angle. All right, any comments or questions about that setup? If you've never seen that before, the connection of those guys, where they are, then get back into those letters and be prepared to see it differently. Let's talk about Jeremiah a little bit. Open your Bible to Jeremiah chapter 29. He prophesied a long time to Jeremiah, so his scope is larger than some of these other guys. He started prophesying in about 626, 20 years before the attack. He's telling the people, here's what's coming, here's what you need to do about it. He prophesies all the way through that first attack and the second and the third. So notice the dates I gave you. Started prophesying about 626, prophesied to about 572. That's a lot of stuff that he was there for. In Jeremiah chapter 29, let me get over there, in verse 1, Jeremiah 29 verse 1. Now these are the words of the letter which Jeremiah the prophet sent from Jeremiah to the rest of the elders of the exile, the priests, the prophets, all the people whom Nebuchadnezzar had taken into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. So it looks like he wrote letters and sent them to the captives, to where Ezekiel was. He's reporting from home and what was left behind. And you get a lot of little passages like that so you can fill in the details. Look at chapter 32 really quickly. Jeremiah 32, 1 and 2. Just gives you some names so you know where you are. Jeremiah 32, verse 1. The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord in the 10th year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, which was the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar. For at that time, the army of the king of Babylon was besieging Jerusalem, and Jeremiah the prophet was shut up in the court of the guard, which was in the house of the king of Judah. All right, so that last attack, he's in the city at the time. He's locked in. I don't remember the exact context of Jeremiah 32, but his own people may have locked him up. They didn't like this guy. There's something about telling everybody that your entire life's about to be destroyed because of you. And it's going to last this long because of you. And your idea to move to Egypt is a dumb one. You shouldn't do it. And they do it anyway. That makes you a less than, I don't know, popular prophet, I guess. So he was oftentimes captive by his own people, but his facts just kept coming true over and over again. The book of Lamentations is Jeremiah lamenting over the burnt city. And after they fled to Egypt, he actually prophesied there as well. So a lot of information, Jeremiah. You would do very well when reading Jeremiah to have something next to you, some reference material that can at least give you sort of the dates, and just write those in your margin so that when you open up your Bible to Jeremiah 15, you kind of have some idea of where in the world we are. His book has a lot of scope to it. That's the difference between those major prophets and those minor prophets. Those minor prophets are tight. They're written to one people at one time about one thing. These major prophets talk a lot about a lot of stuff. All right, so that's Jeremiah. Remind me again, how is Ezekiel's perspective different? All right, taken in which attack? So he saw some things back home as well. He was left behind after the first attack. He saw a lot of that as well. But then he was taken in, and Ezekiel chapter 1, it talks about how he doesn't start prophesying until he gets there. They're there. They've been captive, and that's when God calls him to action. I just have to say something about verse 1, Ezekiel 1:1. I did a little Wednesday night talk at Humble, Texas, where I grew up worshiping. I started doing talks, got pretty excited about them on Wednesday nights. And I said I was going to do one on Ezekiel, and I started off, and I was probably 17 at the time. And I said, now it came about in the 13th year, on the first day of the fourth month, while I was by the river Chebar among the exiles, the heavens were opened, I saw a vision of God. Verse 3, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel and basically told me to go prophesy. And I said, look at that, 13 years old, just a kid like me, and God could use him. And I mean, I'm getting going. I got the hands going. I'm leaning in. Anyway, so I get done. My whole point's about young people serving God. And of course, yeah, it says 30th right there. In case you flipped over the top of that, it says in his 30th year, which I've now decided is also young. At the time, I thought it was pretty old. Also pretty young. All right, so he's 30 years old, and he's captive, and Ezekiel is taken. That's at the bottom of your page. We'll do Daniel last. Ezekiel's prophecy, about 20 years there. And that it's smaller span because he didn't get started until he was in exile. And that's what he did. You can look at the passages I gave you. He talked to them about it. It was a lot of, yeah, you're the reason we're here. We're here because of what we have done. But God will get a remnant home. If you will stay faithful these 70 years, God will take a remnant home. So there's a little bit of hope, but a lot of straight talk. All right, let's take a look at the book of Daniel. This is one of which we are probably most familiar, the three. Let's head over to Daniel chapter 1. Daniel's perspective, utterly different than those guys. He saw death and destruction during the first attack, but he didn't have to stay and see what was left behind. He got taken in that first attack. And he's a young man, and he goes to Babylon, and he does a lot of prophesying to the king. You can pick up a little bit in his story. You probably know this story well in Daniel chapter 1. It talks about verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, that's right there at that 605, 606, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. In verse 3, the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of the officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom there was no defect, good-looking guys, smart guys, and so forth. And among them, verse 6, are Daniel and guys that we would later know as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You get their Hebrew names in verse 6. And then you see it. Verse 8, Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself. All right. We've all done the little pictures of Daniel in the lion's den. When Daniel, their kids are coloring the picture of Daniel in the lion's den. Is he old or young in those pictures? You guys remember? hearing a lot of mumblings. I'm not hearing old or young. I'm just looking for, was he old guy? Do you remember? Middle age. All right. What's that look like? A couple little wrinkles, a little bit of gray. You know, I think the ones that I remember seeing, he was like everybody else, this long gray, old beard. Or maybe not. Seen a young one? Well, was he old or young when he was in the lion's den? Don't stare at me like that. This is a complete trick question. He was very old by, he actually was about 70 years old by then. His story, these six chapters, start with an 18-year-old, just a kid, just a young man. Do we have his age or am I assuming that? I think we just have him in his youth as a teenager. He starts really, really young. And then by the time we get over to chapter 6 and the lion's den, which we're really familiar with all that, Nebuchadnezzar isn't king anymore. You have Darius, who's the king. Nebuchadnezzar's gone. Belshazzar and the handwriting on the wall, he's gone. In fact, when you get over here to Daniel and the lion's den, you've moved on to the Persians. It's a long time. It's probably, it's about 60 years, I think. So Daniel 1 through 6 is a wide scope of about 60 years. Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, Darius, and he was old in the lion's den. So keep that perspective when you're reading the book of Daniel. Those six chapters move really fast. And it just sort of tells you about, here's what he told Nebuchadnezzar, here's what he told Belshazzar, here's what he told Darius. When you think about the book of Daniel and Jesus, we're always looking for the messianic promises in Israelites' history. What passages come to mind for you as prophecies about the Son of God? Say again?
Isaiah 53.
In Daniel. Daniel. Yeah, she's exactly right. Isaiah 53. In Daniel's letter. How interesting that he's not prophesying to the Israelites, prophesying to Nebuchadnezzar. And yet in Daniel, there's two of them, and both answers were correct. In Daniel 2:44, when he's interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's statue dream, and you've got the head of gold, and you know, you've got Babylon and Persia and Greece and Rome. In verse 44, he brings in this promise that when you finally get to that fourth kingdom, God will set up in the days of the Roman kings a kingdom which will never be destroyed. Daniel 2:44. He did the same thing a lot later in Daniel chapter 7 when he told Belshazzar about four creatures, four beasts. And in the time of the fourth beast, Daniel 7:7, in the time of this dreadful, terrifying, extremely strong iron teeth beast, well, something else would come about. Verses 13 and 14, the Ancient of Days would come. Jesus came in the days of Roman kings. Awesome. Daniel 2, Daniel 7. All right, our study is not about the book of Daniel, but I'll leave you one hint that'll help you. Daniel 1 through 6, it's kind of like the Old Testament. You know how the Old Testament has books of history? And then all the prophets fit inside of it? Y'all heard me say that already? Books of history, Nehemiah, all the prophets fit back in like this. Daniel 1 through 6, history. Daniel 7 through 12, prophecies that fit back inside of it. When you see it that way, it really helps you a lot. Because you just read about Belshazzar dying, and now you're at Darius, and then chapter 7 goes back to Belshazzar. What in the world's going on? Second half are prophecies that happened during that 60-year period. Might help you a little bit in study. All right, any comments or questions about the Babylonian captivity, the three dates, the three contemporaries who were there? All right. We make it through lesson 8, we're home free. Returns from captivity, top of page 31. Just as God promised through Jeremiah, the Jews were freed after 70 years captive. The Babylonian Empire fell to the combined Medes-Persian, Medo-Persian Empire. Daniel records the deposing of the final Babylonian king and Darius the Mede taking over in Babylon. That's where we were a minute ago. Remember that lion's den? That's not Babylon at all. They're gone. The lion's den story is the Medo-Persian Empire that came about after it. Daniel records the deposing. Ezra, a letter that recounts the history of the first two returns, opens by noting that Cyrus is now the Persian king over all the known world and immediately begins to fulfill the promise God made to his people. Personal opinion, Ezra and Nehemiah overlooked. As far as history goes, they're just as rich as any of the kings of the Chronicles or Samuel. Ezra and Nehemiah tell you the story of what happened after all this. After the 70 years and it was time to go home and rebuild, how did that work? What did the people do? Ezra and Nehemiah. One quick note, in case you're thinking it, there may be two people in the room who are thinking it. When the Medo-Persians took over Babylon, there were two kings. Cyrus, the head honcho, the Persian ruler, who was in Susa. But what are you going to do in Babylon? You know, Babylon was the old guard. What if they revolt there in Babylon and Cyrus is over here doing his Susa rule the world thing? What if Nebuchadnezzar's descendants try to get things going again? You know what we need to do? We need to put us sort of like a sub-king in Babylon to keep that from happening. We're the Medo-Persian Empire. So I guess if I'm Cyrus the Persian, I'll go ahead and put a Medo king over here. So it's just me and him. That guy's name is what? Darius. That's the lion's den story, Daniel 6. They're in Babylon. Darius the Mede is ruling things, and the whole story unfolds just like you remembered for a long, long time. But that explains a little bit about how Ezra says, Cyrus became king and sent us home. But Daniel says, Darius became king after all this, and this is what happened. Both of those things were true. Historically accurate truths. All right. Okay, if there's one thing in the entire Bible survey material, all 12 lessons that you will never, ever, ever, ever remember, you're about to see it. The dates of the first, second, and third return. It's okay if we don't remember these, but I do want to sell to you sort of the impact of Ezra and Nehemiah. Three returns, three captivities, 606, 597, 586, three returns. You're familiar with the guys who led the second two returns, but maybe a little less familiar with that first guy. The first return was led by Zerubbabel. Okay, open up to Zerubbabel chapter 3. Let me show that to you. You know you looked. I was at a gospel meeting last year, and a guy came up and said, I really enjoyed your sermon, but I have a question about a verse. Could you go to Hezekiah chapter 4? And I was like, Hezekiah chapter 4. He got me, so sometimes that happens. All right? How many animals did Moses put on the ark? All right. There is no book of Zerubbabel, but he was an incredibly important character. He's the guy who took the helm to lead the people back home the first time. And when they got back to Jerusalem, what did it look like? Yikes. Everything was gone. The temple was destroyed. The homes were burned. I was visiting, in August of 2014, I was up in the northeastern part of the country where civil war and war of independence and all that was fought. And they were showing pictures of the city of Richmond after the other armies had come through. And all you had in the city of Richmond were chimneys, the brick. Everything else was destroyed. That's kind of like what they would have had here, except even the bricks were not left one upon the other. I mean, it was complete destruction. Zerubbabel comes back and he says, first things first, we need to rebuild the temple. We have to get that thing back going. Worshiping God is our number one priority. So they lay the foundation of the temple. Here's what we'll do for Wednesday night. That is an incredible story. Here's what I want you to do. If you get some time in the next few days, do yourself the bestest of favors and read Ezra. And maybe when you start getting into it and you love it like you're going to love it, read Nehemiah as well. Ezra and Nehemiah. And if you really want to go a step further, read Haggai. Now, maybe you're one of those people who've thought, I've never had interest in Haggai. I never think I would have interest in Haggai. Read Ezra, and then go read Haggai, and you watch what happens. You'll come back on Wednesday night, and you'll say, I know exactly what that guy was doing, and I get it now. If you haven't done that before. So let's get that going for us on Wednesday night. We will move forward. We're doing well on pace. Probably we'll finish this lesson Wednesday night. Thank you, guys.